Coming up on Which Way Is Life, the podcast designed to help you find a healthier, inspired life, episode number 27. My guest today, therapist Lisa Ference. We talk about her book, Finding Your Ruby Slippers, Transformative Life Lessons from the Therapist's Couch. And we go into why negative self-talk is so bad for you, and she shares transformative life lessons. She is awesome. She rocks it. That's coming up. Make sure you listen to the whole episode. And if I could ask, just hit the subscribe button wherever you listen to catch every episode. Which Way Is Life is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/whichwayislife. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Which Way Is Life is also brought to you by Real Salt. You get all the minerals, all the flavor, and all the benefits of sea salt. That's real salt brand sea salt.
Which Way Is Life? Your roadmap to a healthier, inspired life. Bill talks with trendsetting doctors, fitness gurus, life coaches, celebrities, athletes, and other interesting experts to help you find the life you want to live. Get inspired, get healthy, reconnect with life. Here's Bill Klaproth.
This is the podcast designed to help people live a healthier, inspired life with great guests like my guest today, Lisa Ference, who is on with us. Lisa is an internationally known speaker, clinician, and consultant who has been in private practice for over 30 years. She is the founder of the Ference Institute and author of the upcoming book, Finding Your Ruby Slippers, Transformative Life Lessons from the Therapist's Couch. She is here to share strategy for those struggling with personal and professional obstacles to help them grow and thrive. Lisa, so happy to talk with you today. Can you let us in on your personal life? Who are you when you're not saving the world?
Well, you know, saving the world is a full-time occupation.
It is.
I think, you know, it's a great question, actually. I consider myself an educator and a nurturer, and I am the mother of three wonderful grown sons, and I am a wife and a daughter and a teacher and a dancer and an actress, and so I have the great privilege of wearing many hats in my life.
Oh, my, that sounds like a full life. I love it.
It is.
A dancer and an actress on top of being a mom and an author and a businesswoman. I love it. Well, Lisa, I like to start the show with what I call the one thing. Are you ready?
I am, yes.
Can you quickly share with us one thing someone can do to improve their life today?
You know, the thing that immediately comes to my mind is to talk to yourself with more self-compassion. Mm. I actually think there's nothing more powerful than the way we talk to ourselves about ourselves. And I can tell you as a therapist that one of the things that I hear really frequently throughout a therapy session are people talking to themselves in ways that are very demeaning and shaming. And when I can kind of pause that moment and invite the person to just consider the possibility, is there a gentler way that you could say that to yourself? Or is there a kinder way that you could think about that? It actually can create a very profound opening and shift for that person. So I'm all about paying attention to how we talk to ourselves about ourselves.
So cut the negative self-talk.
Yeah, you know, or at least be open to the possibility that there's another way. There's a kinder way, a gentler way, a softer way. And obviously when somebody is more involved in therapy, we can then go deeper and look at where did you learn to talk to yourself in negative ways? You know, whose voice is that really? What would it mean if you stopped talking to yourself in such a negative way? You know, what would you gain? What would you lose? So there's certainly, we can certainly mine that in much deeper ways. But just for starters, just getting the people in your audience to begin to be more mindful of how they do talk to themselves about themselves. You know, really bringing that into conscious awareness, I think can be a very powerful first step.
All right, Lisa, let me ask you this. We're all human. We all make mistakes, and a lot of times we're like, God, it was so stupid. You're such an idiot. What did you do that for?
Yeah.
Right? We do that, and that's that negative self-talk. So when we do stupid things because we're human and we all do dumb things from time to time, what do we replace that negative self-talk with?
Well, I mean, the first thing I just want to point out, Bill, is that when we go down that road, that in no way is going to increase the likelihood that we'll do a better job next time. And in fact, the paradox is that the more negatively we talk to ourselves, the more likely it is that we will make more mistakes. And because it's not going to resonate to take the time to think something through or reach out and get support when we need it. So that you kind of hit on, I think, a universal myth, which is that we can motivate through bullying and shaming. And I can tell you after doing this work for, you know, over 33 years that it is not motivating to shame. So when we do, when we have the awareness that we have made a mistake, the thing that I like to go to is you win some and you learn some. So it's not about failing, it's not about losing, it's about how can I take that half step back and learn something? How can I turn this into a teachable moment so that I can learn something from the experience and perhaps really dramatically increase the likelihood that the next time around I can do it differently?
You win some and you learn some. I love the way you put that. That makes such sense. And also the way you just said negative self-talk is like bullying or shaming ourselves.
Yeah.
I've never heard it put that way, but when you say that, it's like, oh my gosh, she's right. When we put ourselves down, we're like bullying ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
And we know that bullying is bad. Why are we bullying ourselves? We need to be more kinder and gentler to ourselves, just like we need to present to the rest of the world.
Exactly. Look, you ask a great question, though. You know, it's a fair question. Like, why would somebody do that to themselves? What I want to suggest is the possibility that that got normalized or that got modeled somewhere along the way. Because I can tell you that the people who are able to talk with compassion to themselves, that doesn't come for no reason either. It's because somebody along the way modeled that kindness. And so conversely, when I encounter somebody who is very shaming and very bullying, I know that really they've internalized the words, the messages, the experiences that they've heard from someone else in the past. So they come by it honestly. You know, I don't think we're wired to want to treat ourselves unkindly, but if it's been normalized, without even thinking about it, it's like we can pick up where an abusive person left off. And that's why having that mindful awareness is the first step towards breaking that cycle and beginning to do something that's different.
That's interesting. So the bully, if you were to hear his inner dialogue, would probably be bullying himself. And that's what he does.
Exactly right. That's right.
That's interesting. It makes you think differently about a bully, about what's causing that person to be a bully. And you almost start to feel sorry for that person. Like, boy, I wonder what that person has been through, that it's manifesting itself in that way. It's coming out that way.
Well, and that's exactly the right question to be curious about, because we want to hold some degree of empathy for people who are unkind to other people. Not that we obviously ever would want to condone their behavior, but it does help to be able to step back and make sense out of or try to understand, is this a manifestation of their unresolved pain or their unresolved trauma? And I can tell you it almost always is. You know, people who are treated in loving ways tend to treat other people in loving ways and tend to treat themselves in loving ways. And for the folks who are unkind, either verbally or even physically towards other people, it's usually because that's how they've been treated in some way in the past.
So to my beautiful listener, I love you. Do not bully yourself. Okay? Take it from Lisa. Don't do it.
Right. But you know what, Bill? Even that message has to be given with a lot of kindness, you know, because we don't want to. My job as a therapist is to never shame anybody for having the realization that they have been unkind to themselves, because that can, you know, that can defeat the purpose. So it's giving that message, as I think you just did, in a very loving and supportive kind of way, so that we can quickly move people away from getting stuck in the shame that often gets evoked when people have the realization that they have not spoken to themselves with kindness.
So, Lisa, you say making decisions from what is rather than what was or what could be is important. Can you explain that?
Sure. You know, as a therapist, what I see so often is that when people are faced with important decisions, sometimes it's about, I'll give you a concrete example, whether or not I should stay in a relationship with somebody. And often what I hear is, you know, he used to be so good to me. You know, she used to treat me with such kindness, or she used to be so available to me. And they're holding on to that relationship based on what was in the past. And the other thing that I often hear is, you know, he's not really good to me now, but boy, do I believe in his potential. I know that one day he's going to wake up and he's going to realize that I deserve to be treated with respect, and then everything's going to be great. So in either of those instances, that person might be making a very important life decision, in this case, whether or not to stay in a relationship, based on either how things used to be or how they're hoping things will be. And what I try to get people to focus on is the reality of what is, because that's really your best indicator of how things are, and that's what's impacting your thoughts, your feelings, and your choices in the present. So it's helping people to not either be stuck in the past or to not put too much stock in what they hope will be, but really to take very honest inventory about what is. Sometimes what is can be quite wonderful, and we miss it. We're not focused on it because we're more either stuck in the past or we're thinking ahead. Sometimes we're in denial about the present not being so good. Perhaps it's an abusive relationship, or maybe we're in a toxic workplace. And so being able to be honest about what is, I think, helps people to make, you know, genuinely good decisions about what's in their best interest, not based on the past and not based on the future, but based on what's happening right now.
I love that thinking and the logic behind that. I imagine that would be tough for people to put into practice if you're always thinking, well, you know, he's gonna, you know, he was a good guy and I know he's got potential. If, how do you break into that being very conscious of the moment and what is, just, okay, forget about in the future or what happened. What is the reality right now? How do we get to that point where we really are aware and awake and can think about that question? What is right now? How do we get there?
So, you know, you somewhat answered that with two pieces. The first is learning how to be more in the present moment, really pausing more, taking the time to what I call take our own emotional temperature and really go inside and ask ourselves, in the present moment, right now, what am I feeling? What am I needing? You know, am I satisfied? Is there something that I'm wishing that I could have in this moment that I don't have? So part of it is just practicing this mindful awareness of every present moment. But I think the other thing that you actually kind of subtly alluded to is helping people understand that they don't have the power to fix or change anybody else. And so the person who's banking on, you know, figure out sort of the magic key that unlocks the door that gets their partner to be exactly how they want them to be, or figuring out the key that's going to open the door that makes everything wonderful at work. In a way, it's giving ourselves the kind of power that we don't have. And so it is a humbling but also a freeing realization that the only person that we ever have the power to control or change is ourselves. And so when we let go of the idea that I'm going to figure out how to get this person to be different, letting go of that, I think, is part of what frees us up to start to pay attention to what is happening now in the present moment. And I think it's that combination of things that can slowly move people into facing that reality. But you're certainly not wrong in suggesting that it's a tough thing to put into practice. You know, people put a lot of stock in what was, or, you know, in their hopes for the future. I think that's human nature, and it's not like we want to pathologize that. It's just that, as a therapist, I can tell you that so many people make decisions in their current life that in no way meet their present needs because they're stuck in either the past or the future.
Mm-hmm. I think the key word you use is practice.
Yes.
This doesn't just, okay, I'm going to snap my fingers and I'm going to be more aware and going to live in the moment. It takes practice of catching your thoughts and saying, okay, what am I feeling right now? And working on that to really get to where you need to be with your thoughts, and then actually living in the moment and working on that what is. Is that correct?
You're 100% correct, Bill. You know, you're actually citing something that has neurological basis, which is this. We know that we don't create new ways of being, new ways of thinking or feeling, unless we engage in repetition. So you are exactly right. The only way that we build kind of new neural pathways in our brain is through the act of repetition. So you're right. If I'm in a therapy session and I point something out one time to a client, I cannot expect that in that one moment there's going to be this magical transformation. So it's something that has to be constantly revisited, again with compassion, again with patience, without any shaming or bullying. And then over time, it can become that person's reality. But you're so right. It really does take a lot of practice. And one of the chapters in my book, I talk about act as if, and then it slowly mm-hmm. becomes a reality. And so I think that kind of fits into what we're talking about here, that even to say to somebody, you know, I'm going to act as if I have the ability to live in the present moment. And if I rehearse that, engage in that, and tell myself, you know, that I can do this, slowly it actually becomes a reality for us.
Act as if. Okay. And you also said then when you catch your thoughts, pay attention to your feelings. So if you're in a relationship and you're feeling anxious, or you're feeling that this person doesn't respect me, or food, why am I eating this? Why am I overeating? Why do I turn to alcohol? You're saying catch those feelings and then really understand those feelings, and that can lead you to the answer where you can change that behavior.
That's exactly right. Boy, you're doing a beautiful job of hitting on all the different chapters in my book. I'm very impressed, Bill.
I'm very lucky.
I think it's a great segue into one of my chapters where I talk about listen to the uh-oh feeling inside of you or in your stomach, because our bodies are a kind of compass, and they really do talk to us. And I think a lot of roads keep leading back to this idea of mindfulness, paying attention, slowing down, really taking the time to notice, you know, what our bodies are actually saying to us. So, you know, whether it's that we're overeating or we're drinking too much or in a relationship that is emotionally unfulfilling, so much of those dysfunctional or destructive experiences do manifest through feelings that are both emotional but that are also somatic on our bodies. And so you're right, if we can pay more attention to our emotional state and also pay more attention to the sensations on our body, that's a great window into understanding what we're really feeling and needing and wanting and possibly not getting.
And this is the perfect time of year to talk about that self-realization of needing and wanting, because we all get into New Year's resolutions. This or something I want to change about myself. I want to lose weight, or I want to quit smoking, and I want to be a better parent, or whatever it is. We all do that, and then a lot of times the resolutions, Lisa, just don't stick. So how can we take steps that help us to reach our goals for the new year, but then sustain those goals for the long term?
So you are so right. I will tell you, the research says that 90% of us either forget about the resolutions or lose our willpower by the end of January. So everybody
right.
makes the resolutions, you know, January 1st or December 31st, and within a month, 90% of us let those things go. So I think it's really important to go a little bit deeper. It's not just about naming the things that we want to change, mm-hmm. but I think we have to ask ourselves some deeper questions. And some of the questions I encourage my clients to ask include things like, are you making that resolution to change you, or are you making it because someone else wants you to do it? Because what we know about human nature is, believe it or not, we're far more motivated to make changes if they truly resonate for us, and we're far less likely to follow through with resolutions if we're doing it for someone else. Actually, that over time can create a lot of resentment and a lot of bitterness. So we have to take a closer look at what's motivating us to make that resolution, and who is it for? So I think it has to be for us. We have to have personal buy-in, or else it's not something that we're going to sustain. I also ask my clients to look at, what will you gain if you do sustain the resolution? Like, where is that goal going to really bring you to? What's waiting you at the finish line? What's going to tangibly change in your life? How will you very concretely benefit from engaging in that resolution? Because the truth is, we need a payoff, you know, and we need to be able to very specifically identify, here's what I would gain. Not anything vague, but here's something very substantive and real that I would gain if I followed through with sustaining that resolution. And then, believe it or not, I also ask people to look at, what will you lose if you you keep to that resolution. Because the behavioral things that we want to let go of, the truth is we were doing them for so long because we got something from them. So you use the example of, you know, giving up an addiction perhaps or overeating. But the truth is, for many people, those behaviors are a source of self-medication, and they're a way to self-soothe and a way to feel numb. And not that that's positive, it's just that's their repertoire of coping. So if they're really going to commit to not drinking anymore or not using food, they have to start to look at what can they replace those coping strategies with so that they can sustain letting go of the alcohol or the food. So I always have my clients look at, you know, what they're going to lose. And then I have them look at what are the obstacles that might prevent them from keeping the resolutions. You know, ironically, people come up with the same resolutions every single year. So it's right. worth looking at what are the obstacles year in and year out that have kind of stopped you in your tracks and prevented you from really moving forward with what you're saying you want to do. Are the obstacles happening from inside of you? Are they interpersonal? Are they situational? Are they environmental? So it's helpful to understand when I look back on the past 5 years of saying, I'm going to lose the weight, and it hasn't happened, to really try to understand again without shame, what is it that's gotten in the way? And the other thing that I bring up is the resolution that you're wanting to make, is it truly doable? Or are you inadvertently setting yourself up to fail by having the goal be too big or, you know, unmanageable or, frankly, just not realistic, you know, given your current life circumstances? So people often, you know, on January 1st say, I'm going to lose 50 pounds. That's not reasonable. That's not practical. That is an absolute setup to fail. So it's a world of difference to say, I'm going to change one thing about my eating habits. I'm going to, you know, increase one thing that I do for exercise, even if it's just once a week or for 15 minutes a week. So it's about making the goal manageable and doable, because we always want to kind of set ourselves up to succeed and not set ourselves up to fail. And lastly, have a cheerleader. So I really believe in the power of telling people whom you trust that this is your resolution and this is what you're working towards, and ask for their help. Ask them to check in with you. Ask them to be motivational. Ask them to notice even the small little shifts that you're making as you move in the right direction, because we all respond to positive reinforcement. You know, that's how we're wired as human beings.
It's kind of like having that health buddy with you that you're accountable too.
Right. Accountability is a great word. I think that's definitely a part of it. You're far more likely to follow through when you know that you've told three people, you know, that this is something that you really want to try to achieve.
Well, Lauren, those are great tips for the new year. So are you doing it for you or someone else? So
right.
That's number one. And then, as we talked about earlier, real change starts in your own mind. You can only control yourself. You can't control anybody else. So really, you've got to want it for you.
Right.
And then, as you said, what are you going to gain? What are you going to lose? What are my obstacles? And then make sure it's doable. You're right to say, I'm going to lose 50 pounds. You're setting yourself up for failure. But if you say to yourself, you know what, instead of drinking 4 cans of Diet Coke, I'm going to drink 3 cans for the next 2 weeks. And I'm going to swap out the 1 can for water. And instead of eating chips for lunch, I'm going to bring celery stalks. So
if you
put the goals in, frame it that way, the goal is much more achievable, and you will find more success, and that will lend itself to lasting success as well.
Exactly. And you know, the way we sort of are wired as human beings, when we're able to have one small success, we build on it. You know, so to use your example, if I had that success of I drank a bottle of water instead of that Diet Pepsi, that evokes a positive feeling of competence and success, and I'm going to do more of it the following week, you know? So we want to take those small baby steps. I always tell my clients, if you take enough baby steps, you still wind up completely across the room.
That's great.
So it's not about
it.
Leaping. You know, you don't have to leap across the room. It's just take enough little steps and you still get there.
Right. Oh, I that's a great analogy. And when you're talking about the little wins and feeling good, you know, a feel good, begets another feel good. You want to feel good again. So one good decision leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. It's those little baby steps. And before you know it, you're across the room. So that's really good stuff. Well, coming up, we get the high five from Lisa. And if I could ask a favor, I have one simple goal for this podcast. I want people to walk away with something they've heard to improve their life, to make their life better, to have more joy. Some of the great stuff that Lisa is telling us today. So if you could, after the interview with Lisa, jump on over to iTunes, rate and review the podcast. If you could do that for me, we gain a wider audience, and it gives us a chance to help more people, which we're all about. Well, coming up, we get the high five with Lisa. That's next. Which Way is Life is brought to you by Audible.com. And just for listening to Which Way is Life, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check it out. So if you like listening to podcasts like this one, you're going to love Audible.com. So I would recommend you check it out and browse all the books you can download for free with a 30-day trial. Just go to audibletrial.com/ and then type in Which Way is Life. Again, that's audibletrial.com/ Which Way is Life for your free audio book. Which Way is Life is also brought to you by Real Salt. Now, you probably already use sea salt on your food because you know of its health benefits, but is your salt real? Take a look at the ingredients panel. You might be surprised by what's inside. A lot of salts contain fillers, anti-caking chemicals, even dextrose, which is a type of sugar. So you want a salt like Real Salt that hasn't been stripped of its minerals or had chemicals added. Real Salt. You get all the minerals, all the flavor, and all the benefits of sea salt. That's real. Real Salt brand sea salt. Find it at your local health food store or go to realsalt.com. Time for the high five with my guest, Lisa Ferentz. Lisa, are you ready?
I am ready.
Question number one. Now, we know the ruby red slippers are magic slippers worn by Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. So why the reference in the title of your new book?
Oh, great question. So here's the answer. If you think about the movie, Dorothy spends the entire movie assuming that the wizard is the secret to getting her back home. And all the other characters think the same thing. The Tin Man, the Cowardly Lion, they're all convinced that the wizard, something outside of themselves, is the thing that's going to get them back home, metaphorically. And what Dorothy discovers at the end of the movie is that she's been wearing the ruby slippers all along, meaning that everything that she needs to self-actualize and to have a sense of inner peace and to metaphorically find her way back home has been on her own feet all along. So the whole book is about the ways in which we can look inward to find the wisdom and the strength and the creativity and the resiliency to live, you know, life to the best ways that we can and to really feel a sense of inner peace and contentment. So we've got the answers inside of us.
That is so good. We have the power within us all for change and to create a life well lived.
Yeah, that's it.
So good. Question number two. So in your travels, your resume is a mile long. You've experienced so many great things, and you've helped so many people along the way. But along the way, I'm sure you've had a mentor or somebody that counseled you. What's the best piece of advice you were ever given?
Oh, my goodness. What a question. You know, I have been so blessed in my life. I have incredibly loving parents who from day one really made me feel as if I was worthy and valuable and that I deserved to be treated with respect. And so I think about being told over and over that I was a worthy person. And I also was taught that it was important to make a difference in the world. I got that from my parents. I got that from my grandmother as well. And so the idea of use whatever gifts you've been given to make a difference in the world. And it can be a very small difference and it can be a big difference. But I think that's the way to ultimately feel that your life has been fulfilling and meaningful. So that combination of being told that I was worthy and that it also was my responsibility to pay it forward and to make a difference in the world really has guided all of the work that I do.
Okay, question number three. So what inspires you most in everyday life?
Well, you know, there's so many things that inspire me, but the thing that immediately comes to mind is my 3-year-old cockapoo.
Oh.
Because, yes, although I must tell you, I'm quite inspired by my three beautiful grown sons and my wonderful husband and my family. But there's something quite extraordinary. I've never had a dog before. And having this little cockapoo, on a daily basis, she reminds me, actually, to live in the moment and to savor every sight and sound around me and to not sweat the small stuff. She is totally unconditional. She never holds a grudge. She is filled with joy every time she sees me. And I actually think that if we all could live our lives and be the people that our dogs think we are, I think that we would be living extraordinary lives. So she inspires me a lot.
I love that. And when you think about a dog, you're right. They are thrilled when you come home and jumping around and happy. And
right.
Wow, that is so cool. And I love that you know that and realize that, because I think a lot of people don't really get in touch with joy every day. So
yeah.
Just by you saying that, I love hearing that. I think that's cool.
Good.
Question number four. Besides your own book, do you have a favorite book or maybe a favorite quote you can share with us?
Okay. So one of the quotes that I really live by, believe it or not, comes from a science fiction writer, Aldous Huxley. And what he said a very long time ago is, experience is not what happens to you, it's what you do with what happens to you. Mm. And I can tell you, as somebody who's worked with trauma survivors, you know, for a very, very long time, that is so comforting for me, and it's comforting for my clients, because we can never undo or change what's happened to them. However, I can help them to see that so much of their power lives in what they choose to do with what's happened to them, and the meaning that they choose to attach to it. So I actually have that quote in my waiting room, and it's a very important mantra to me as a clinician. And the other thing that I live my life by, although I am not in the 12-step movement, I'm fortunate in that I don't have any addiction issues, but I think the Serenity Prayer, which talks about basically understanding what we do and don't have control over and letting go of what we can't control and fully embracing and acting on what we can control, I think that's quite a brilliant way to live your life. So those are the two quotes that come to mind that really move me and very much inform both my professional and my personal life.
Lisa, thanks for sharing those. We will post both of those up on the show notes page at RadioMD.com. All right, question number five, last question. Being a therapist and helping people, what's the biggest problem you run into or you see that you think could be easily fixed in our thing called the human race?
Oh, my goodness, that's a tough question. I think one of the tougher problems that I've encountered, frankly, is the way parents can sometimes treat their children, because I know full well the long-term reverberating impact that that has. I'm not suggesting that that's an easy fix at all, but boy, if I had a magic wand, that would be one of the things that I would really want to try to fix or change, is to teach parents to talk to their children in loving ways, because for so much of our lives, our parents hold up mirrors to us and they tell us this is who we are and this is what we should expect from life and this is how we should expect to be treated. And I see the intergenerational dynamic of abuse. And so I understand the power of what happens when a parent does not securely attach to their child and does not give them what they need. And then that child goes up and perpetuates that in the next generation. So if we could change that and we could really teach parents how extraordinarily important it is to raise children to feel safe and cherished and loved, it would solve so many of the world problems, Bill. So that's a tall order, I know, but it's part of what I try to do in my work, frankly, is to teach people new ways to be loving towards their children so that we can break the generational cycle of abuse and neglect, you know, in family systems.
It could be the most important message of all, actually. And as we talked about at the beginning of the interview, the negative self-talk, and you said it starts earlier, it's kind of ingrained earlier. So if we are more compassionate and kind and loving with our children, hopefully that negative self-talk won't be inside of them and perpetuated throughout their own life.
That's
and we will
exactly
get
right.
We will get a kinder, more compassionate society, which we are in dire need of at all times, especially these crazy times we live in.
Agreed. Yes.
Oh my.
I know. Well, that's a whole other conversation.
That's a whole other podcast, right? Oh, boy.
Right.
So, but Lisa, thank you so much. I've so enjoyed talking with you. How can we connect with you, learn more about you, get your new book? Tell us all that good stuff.
Great. So I actually have three books. We talked about the newest one, which is Finding Your Ruby Slippers. But I also have written two books that relate to treating self-destructive behaviors. And so all three of those books people can find on Amazon, or they can go to my website, which is lisaferrance.com. They can also go to my professional page on Facebook and get all kinds of free resources, and they can see me on LinkedIn and Twitter. But the easiest way to get to me, though, is just lisaferrance.com. That'll bring you to all the different resources that I have.
So good. And again, we will put all the links to Lisa on the show notes page at radiomd.com. Lisa, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I'm going to leave you with one of my favorite quotes here, which is, enjoy the little things in life, because one day you will look back and realize they were the big things. Lisa, thank you so much again.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you for the wonderful message and work that you're doing as well.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you again.
Okay, take care.
I appreciate you listening, and hopefully you got some great stuff with that interview with Lisa Ferrance. And remember to catch every episode of Which Way Is Life. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or my show page at radiomd.com. And when you go there, just search Which Way Is Life or hit the podcast button. You'll get a drop down of all the fabulous podcasts on Radio MD. And then just look for Which Way Is Life. You'll see my picture there. Don't pay attention to that, but just click on it. That'll take you to my page, and you'll see all of my episodes right there. And if I could ask a favor, please take 30 seconds and rate the podcast on iTunes. Jump over there. The reason being is we want to attract more people like you to the show, and the only way we can do that is if you rate it, and it helps us gain a wider audience, and it gives us a chance to help more people. So if you could do that, I really would appreciate it. Which Way Is Life is produced by RadioMD.com, award-winning health podcast. I'd also like to thank my producer, Pamela Lamore. I'm Bill Klaproth. You can find me at Which Way Is Life on Twitter. Make sure you follow me there. Also at Which Way Is Life on Facebook. Same thing there. And again, check out the show notes at radiomd.com for all of my episodes. Thanks for listening, and stay well.